Our reading this morning comes from the book of the prophet Zechariah, chapter 9, verses 9 to 12. You can find it in one of the pew Bibles in front of you on page 797. Zechariah, chapter 9, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he. Humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off. And he shall speak peace to the nations. His rule shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. As for you also, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I will set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Return to your stronghold, O prisoners of hope. Today I declare that I will restore you double. This is God's word for us today. Thanks be to God.
Well, thank you all so much for your patience there. I don't know why we always put the preaching after the kids, because it's kind of an impossible act to follow, but I will do my best. Let's turn to the Lord and ask for his help this morning. God, even as we heard the children tell us, the King is coming. Even as we sang together, we are waiting on you. Lord, would you help us in our waiting? Would you help us even now this morning by speaking to us, and in speaking to us, would you shape us? Would you actually change us and transform us? God, even as we wait, would you conform us to your agenda and not our own? We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, there is an ancient road that leads down from the Mount of Olives, past the Garden of Gethsemane, and back up to the east gate of that old city, Jerusalem. I actually had the privilege of walking this very road back in January of this year. I don't have a photo for you, but you can imagine it with me. Even though it was winter in Israel, it was a sunny day, about 60 degrees. The road today is paved, like most modern roads, but the surroundings are similar to what you might imagine Israel to look like. It's a mixture of rock and grass and olive trees that pepper the hillsides. When you hear mount, like Mount of Olives, don't think mountain, don't think like those white-capped peaks like we have here in the Rockies or something like that. I mean, the Rockies are some 14,000 feet above sea level here for the Mount of Olives and even Mount Zion, where Jerusalem itself sits. We're talking about 2,500 feet above sea level. I mean, comparatively, we're talking about glorified hills. And this well-worn road from the Mount of Olives to the east gate of Jerusalem is a surprisingly short one. In fact, from the very top of the Mount of Olives, before you even begin your descent, you can actually see your destination in full view. I mean, all in all, I think the whole walk took us about 20 minutes and we were taking our time, which was surprising to me in light of how significant that road is in the event that happened on that very road on Palm Sunday long ago. And as you all know by now, this morning is in fact Palm Sunday, the first day of Holy Week, this week that's recognized throughout or by the church throughout the world, commemorating the events of the last week of Jesus' earthly ministry. And on Palm Sunday, the chief event, like the big thing that we remember on Palm Sunday, is that Jesus walked on that pretty short road. And while he walked on that road, he also sat on a donkey, and people got really excited about it. You might be wondering, and you'd perhaps be right to wonder, well, what is the big deal all about? I mean, why is this short journey of such significance as the kickoff to what some have called the greatest week ever in all of human history? Well, it's all because of this one single thing that Jesus did while he was on that ancient road. One small symbolic act that was a bombshell of a statement about himself, about the people who were following him then, and about you and me today. Here's what Jesus was saying on that ancient road on that Palm Sunday, this day some 2,000 years ago, amidst all those shouts of Hosanna and people laying down palm branches and even their own cloaks for Jesus to pass by, amidst all those shouts of rejoicing, what Jesus was saying was that it was right for them to rejoice because we finally have a king who can change everything. We finally have a king who can change everything. Now, I don't know your immediate reaction when you first hear that. It might be something like, hey, I'm an American. I don't have no king. I'm not sure why it felt right to word that with poor grammar, but it just did. Or maybe you're thinking, really? I mean, isn't this just like a little bit of a clear and obvious over-promise? I mean, a king who can change everything? And I can understand that response. Quite frankly, I'm unsure of my ability to completely convince all of you of the truthfulness of that claim. But at the very least, I do want to convince you this morning that that was indeed what Jesus was claiming. That on that road, on that Sunday, he was announcing to you and to me that in himself, we finally have a king who can change everything. Friends, he was making a claim that you and I must wrestle with. And the only way to see that is not simply just to go back to that road some 2,000 years ago. No, the only way we can see that, the only way to make sense of the claim that Jesus was making is to go back some 500 years even farther before the events of that first Palm Sunday. Because it's only from the perspective of a prophet who wrote 500 years before him, and I find it fascinating that Jewish tradition holds that the prophet Zechariah is buried in the graveyard on the top of the Mount of Olives, a graveyard that is still there today. You can see to this day, and I don't know if he really is, but Jewish tradition holds that he is, and I think it's very likely that Jesus would have at least known about that tradition as he set out on this road, fulfilling the words of the prophet who perhaps was buried right there. It's from that perspective we can see that we do finally have a king who can change everything. We see that right from the opening note of Zechariah 9, verse 9, where we see that this despair that is there in the people, this despair is turned into a joy unlike any other joy. That's the first change we see here in this text. There is despair that is changed into joy unlike any other joy. I mean, right out of the gate, we see it there in verse 9. It says, rejoice. I mean, not just like have a little bit of joy, but rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Now look, in one sense, this was written to a particular city, a city unlike any other city. I mean, this is written to Zion, to Jerusalem. Here, daughters, it's just used more of a term of endearment to suggest that it's only the women that should be rejoicing. No, this is a message to all of God's people, his special chosen people, and all throughout the Bible, God's special chosen people have a special place, a place of God's own choosing. And from the time of King David, the very epicenter of that place was Mount Zion and the holy city of Jerusalem that was on it. And if you know the story of the Bible, you might know that God's people, for a time, they were actually ripped away from that city. There was a time when that very city actually laid in ruins. But that's not the situation in Zechariah's time. In Zechariah's time, the people are back in the land. I mean, he's even envisioning a temple that's been rebuilt, and yet there is still a sense that things just aren't the way they're supposed to be. I mean, there are still all sorts of problems, all sorts of conflicts that God's people had with the surrounding nations and surrounding people groups who were all kind of jockeying for power. There were challenges within. I mean, people then had different ideas about what was best for the nation. They were competing ideas of how to restore the nation to the glory that God had promised it would one day have. I mean, there were even disagreements on what it meant to worship God, to be one of his people. And even though they were back in the land, there was disagreement as to whether or not God had returned with them. And so even though this command to rejoice and shout aloud was written to this city that seems like it was thousands of miles away and thousands of years from us, folks, I think that we can actually relate a little bit. And it's not like we live in a culture or a country where things are lying in total ruins, because we're not. We still live in one of the most peaceful, one of the most economically prosperous times in all of human history. We still do. And yet, it's hard to escape being gripped by the sense that things are certainly not what they should be. And we live in a day where it seems like we're more politically divided than ever before. Sadly, sometimes Christians can get caught up in that in some ways that are certainly less than helpful. We're more religiously divided than ever before, not just in the sense of like religious people versus non-religious people, but even among those who would claim the name of Christ, there's disagreement to what that even means. And there's disagreement as to what it is the world around us most needs from us. I think that we might actually have far more in common with that ancient city than we might at first realize. And the question I want to ask is, what reason do we have to think that any of it's ever going to get any better? I mean, we know things aren't what they ought to be, but what reason do we have for optimism? What reason do we have for hope? What reason do you and I have to think that anything in our world today is actually going to change and get better? Or are we just prisoners of hope? I'm grabbing that language from there in verse 12. There's this interesting discussion to what that term means. I mean, is prisoner of hope a prisoner that has hope, or is prisoner of hope someone who is imprisoned by hope? And I'll be honest, I'm not entirely sure which is the better way to take it, but I find that latter to be a bit intriguing. I mean, typically we don't think of hope as a prison, but it certainly can be if we don't have any good reason for it. Just kind of, you know, wishing upon a star, having blind optimism that things will change in our world, things will somehow just get progressively better and better, somehow just maybe perhaps on their own. I mean, that is certainly a way of being shackled. And the line between false hope or naive optimism and despair is certainly a short one, which is kind of the whole point of this passage. We finally have a king who can change everything, which means he can actually give us a cause for turning false hope into real hope. He actually gives us cause, reason to change blind optimism to actual certain expectation, and therefore we can rejoice with a joy that is unlike any other joy, because this thing is rooted in something real, something that it's built on, something that actually lasts. That's why he says to them, he says, I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit, the pit where there is no hope. I will free them. He says, return to your stronghold. I will restore to you double. In other words, even those who perhaps put their hope and trust in God that he would come through, and yet things in this world seemed or made it seem like they were foolish to put their hope in him, what this is saying is, no, rejoice. Rejoice. The prisoners will be freed. God's people will be redeemed. No matter how bad things get in this world, God promises that he will restore double. He will make things right. Not because we're just absolutely so wonderful, not because we are so committed to the right things, but no, he says it's because of the blood of his covenant. In other words, because of the sure and certain promise where God said that he would have a people who would dwell in his special place safely for eternity, we can be sure that he is going to bring it about. Which becomes much clearer here in Zechariah when we see what happens when this king shows up who's going to bring this thing about. We see it there in verse 10. When this king comes, the broken kingdoms of this world will be changed into a kingdom unlike any other kingdom. Friends, the nations of this world will be changed, will be turned into a kingdom, one singular, unified kingdom, unlike any other kingdom. And that's essentially what Zechariah is saying there in verse 10. When this king comes, this king who can change everything, he says, all wars will cease, and peace will rule everywhere. Listen, he says, I will cut off the chariot and the war horse and the battle bow, they shall be cut off. I mean, in modern language, it's like the Lord is saying, I will take your tanks and your planes and your missiles and your guns, and I will break them all apart and melt them and grind them into dust, never, ever to be used again. Never to be used again. Not just because they will no longer be available to us, but because when this king comes, something even bigger is going to happen. He, this coming king, Zechariah tells us, won't just take away the weapons of war. No, he says that he will speak peace to the nations. Not just one city, not even just one nation, not just one people group, but to all nations. Not just the absence of weapons, but the presence of peace, and not limited to one place, but spread out from every corner of the world. His rule, Zechariah says, his dominion, his kingdom shall be from sea to sea and from river to the ends of the earth. I mean, this is a vision so grand, it is all encompassing. Everywhere and all places for all eternity, peace that rules. I mean, what a promise, what a timely promise, especially in our day. I want to ask you a question. If Jesus were to ride up to our city or to our world today, and you could ask him to do anything for our city, I wonder what it would be. As I was thinking about that question myself, my first reaction was that, sadly, I think that so often we live like the thing that we'd most want to ask him for are better restaurants and cooler grocery stores. But I think if we could get through that and actually think a bit more deeply, I think there's a number of great things that perhaps any one of us would ask of him. Maybe that would involve establishing real justice and equity in our world. Maybe that would involve feeding hunger, treating disease, ending homelessness. Maybe that would involve the restoration of families in our society. Maybe it would mean putting an end to all forms of racism and hatred, and especially that might mean eliminating all forms of violence. Just putting an end to them all, finally, once, forever. I think that's probably especially on many of our minds this week. As once again, we turn on the news and see that even as wars rage across the world, so violence rages even in our own land. And afflicts the most innocent among us, even touching our children in places that are supposed to be places of safety and learning and singing. I mean, places that are supposed to be places of hope, because they are filled with the people who are going to people our future. And yet, once again, not the first time this year, and though I pray it's the last, sadly, there's something in me that doubts that. And here Zechariah speaks a word. He has the audacity to speak a word some thousands of years ago to tell us that, guess what? In the coming one, all that can come to an end. And let's be honest, you and I hear that and we're tempted to roll our eyes. Because it sounds like the pat answer, doesn't it? It sounds like the answer that everyone knows is the right answer, but it's the answer that's too good to be true. It's the beauty pageant answer. What do you want in the world today? World peace. And I said before, I may not be able to convince you with absolute certainty that this is going to happen. I know that there are many here among us who are convinced with absolute certainty that this will happen. But I may not be able to convince everyone in this room with absolute certainty that there is coming a day when this really will happen. But the thing, the thing I want to convince you of is that if you're here this morning and you're hearing this, shouldn't you at least want this to be true? I mean, is there something in you, even if you're being honest with yourself and you have doubts and you have skepticism about the reality, could you at least just admit that the possibility of this is the very thing that every single one of us should want? I mean, it does almost seem too good to be true. And maybe that's why it seems far-fetched, and far-fetched because nothing else in all of reality points us to the possibility of this. But friends, that's the whole point of Palm Sunday. The message of Palm Sunday is when it defies our entire experience of reality and it dares us to hope that it might just be possible for everything to change. No human kingdom has ever been able to produce anything close to this. Have you ever asked yourself why? I mean, with everything we know today, with everything we've discovered, with everything that we've learned, with how far we've come in our technological advances and our communication, and we still can't seem to figure out this most basic thing. How do we stop people from hating and killing each other? I mean, you would think that that would be like the most basic thing on everyone's list, like the top of every priority. Like, why are we still sending people to the moon when we haven't got this thing figured out? Maybe this morning, taking a step forward towards faith for you might not look like completely believing that this is the future that this king will bring about, but it's at least acknowledging that every one of us should at least want this to be true. And I acknowledge that what Zechariah is saying here, that there is this coming king who can actually bring about the change that we want and bring all this about. I know it's a bold claim, it's a fairly unique claim, but that's the whole point. The reason we can say that we finally have a king who can change everything is because we finally have a king who was unlike any other king. It's right there in the middle of verse 9. That's what Palm Sunday is all about. Zechariah says this, "Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he." I mean, right there, automatically, this is already a king unlike any other king. I mean, in a rare combination, he has both the character and the ability to bring about the change that we need. He's righteous. He does what is right. He upholds righteousness and justice and rules with goodness, and he's got salvation. I mean, it's his. He can bestow it upon whomever he chooses. I mean, this is one who can actually deliver on his promises, but the thing that really stands out here is how this king makes an entrance. "Behold, your king is coming to you, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." I want you to imagine today, if you were going to make a grand entrance, I mean, what do you think you would choose to roll up in? Right? I mean, as we look at other famous people, celebrity or political or otherwise, we would probably make similar choices. We'd probably want to kind of roll up in a limousine or some other kind of grand vehicle, like a Bentley or a Rolls Royce, or maybe some kind of sports car like an Aston Martin. I don't know, something that just communicates strength and confidence and something that communicates triumph and victory and power. But imagine the one who claims all this rolling up in a station wagon. Or like a minivan. No offense, we've got one. Not like a new minivan. New minivans are cool. They've got like sleek design, they've got all the bells and whistles and automatic things. I'm talking like an old school minivan where you have to put your whole shoulder into it just to open and close the door. I mean, that is in essence the picture, a king unlike any other king who makes an entrance unlike any other. And by that entrance, this king is telling us that he's going to bring about his righteous salvation in a way that is unlike any other. And friends, that's exactly what Jesus was saying on that ancient road long ago on that Palm Sunday. Friends, he wasn't tired. I told you it was a short walk. He didn't need a ride. Though he was very consciously making a statement, he paused. He told his disciples, "Go get me a humble beast of burden, because that's how I'm going to make my arrival." It was Jesus' way of making a clear and public statement. Finally, openly, in the public, to everyone, he was saying, "I am the king that you've been waiting for." And there's a sense in which the people got the message, or at least part of it. I mean, that's why they're waving palm branches and shouting. I mean, they were excited. They knew what Zechariah said. But they were expecting that he would ride into that city and lead a war against the political powers of this world. And they missed the whole message of humility. And listen, friends, Jesus wasn't just interested in doing this as a symbol. Well, the coming of this king who is unlike any other king, the coming of this king in humility was simply paving the way for the events that would unfold in the coming days. We're in that same city, in the most incredible demonstration of humility. The king that we've always been waiting for would be betrayed, arrested, mocked, tortured, and crucified. And the world looks on, both back then and today, and says, what kind of king is that? A king unlike any other king. I want to come back to that question I asked earlier. If Jesus rode into our city today, what would you ask him for? Again, there's a lot of good options. Ending hatred, ending violence, ending disease and hunger and homelessness and inequality. And when he walked into that city then, he wasn't saying no to any of those. In fact, he was actually saying yes to each and every one of those by dealing with the underlying issue that is the ultimate cause of every single one of those problems and more problems than that in our world, the brokenness that is the result of our broken relationship with God because of our sin, because of our rejection of him and his ways. And this king, unlike any other king, is a king unlike any other king because he is the only one who can bring us back into relationship with that God, who can restore us to him and address the issue to take away our sin. And he did it in the greatest demonstration of royal humility in all of human history by humbly going to the cross to pay for our sin. And to most people, it looked like absolute failure. But make no mistake, he is every bit a conquering king. To paraphrase one writer who said it this way, the suffering, humiliation, and death that unfolded on that palm-strewn road he traveled would eventually lead to the conquest of countless human hearts. But listen, friends, the message of Palm Sunday isn't just about the humility of this king. It also speaks a word about the humility of the people of this king. And friends, just like our humble king didn't roll up with power and swag to fight with the weapons of this world, so we who say we follow the king, who say we belong to the king, we must not go out into this world seeking to demonstrate the powers and the strength and all the swag of this world. No, friends, the same thing that this world needed from this king is the same thing this world needs from us. Not reaching and grabbing for political and economic power and privilege in this world, but reaching out in lowly humility, being willing to serve others humbly, even at great cost to ourselves, and pointing others to the king who came, the king who came who can finally change everything. I wonder if he has changed you. I mean, after all, he is a king. I wonder if you've humbled yourself before him. I wonder if you've submitted your life to him as the king. And I wonder if you've done that to the extent that you are willing to go out and humbly serve this broken world by pointing people to that very same king, which is the very thing he calls us to do. And just by way of conclusion, because I've got to wrap this thing up, let me just say a word about this city. I mean, Zechariah certainly describes both a king and a city, a city whose borders know no end. And in one sense, we say, okay, we finally have the king. The king has come. We know who he is. But the reality is that we're still waiting for him to bring about all this change. Now, friends, the truth is, even though this king came, we are still waiting for him to come again. And when this king comes again, he is not going to come in and just change any old earthly city. No, friends, when this king comes again, he is going to bring an entirely new city with him, a new Zion. An eternal Zion, a new Jerusalem, a Jerusalem whose peace knows no end, a Jerusalem that this king will rule to the ends of the earth and to the ends of the ages for all eternity. No, when this king comes back, he will bring the heavenly city with him, and that day, that will be the real, true, triumphal entry of our king. And until that day comes, because that day will come, we can rejoice. Rejoice, O you daughters of Zion. Rejoice, you daughters of the New Jerusalem, because we finally have a king who can change everything. Let's pray. Oh God, this morning, on this Palm Sunday, as we begin this holy week, would you help us? Would you help us to draw all of our attention to the events that transpired in this week and to the king unlike any other king who unfolded them all in this world? And God, would you give us a taste in our gathering, in our worship, not just on this Palm Sunday, but throughout this Holy Week, would you just give us a taste? Would you just give us a glimpse of the incredible joy and the beauty and the peace and the majesty and the worship and the fellowship with one another that we will enjoy together when that city comes in all its fullness. I ask all this in the name of your Son, our precious King.